Hello, I'm Sam Holmes, and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read their pieces from the latest issue. This week, we'll hear from Reverend Marcus Walker about the state of the Church of England, Douglas Murray on transracialism, and Petronella Wyatt on Westminster culture today. First up, Reverend Marcus Walker shares his concern and disapproval at being described by the Church of England as a key limiting factor.
I am a key limiting factor. That's a new one for a clergyman of the Church of England. We've traded under parson, cleric, priest, minister, padre, and even pie and liquor. But never before have I heard us described as key limiting factors. That this phrase was used during the announcement of a new C of E-endorsed scheme to create 10,000 new lay-led churches in the next 10 years adds future injury to present insult. Lay-led churches release the church from key limiting factors, said Canon John McGinley, introducing the initiative. When you don't need a building and a stipend and long, costly college-based training for every leader of the church, then actually we can release new people to lead and new churches to form. Well, maybe. But once you've ditched the buildings, the clergy, and the theological education, you don't have very much of a church left. On one level, this key limiting factor business is rather amusing. It was only in February that the Archbishops of Canterbury and York took to these pages to accuse those of us concerned for the future of the parish system of being, and I quote, rascally voices. The articles Emma Thompson and I wrote for The Spectator were denounced as scaremongering. 5 short months and 1 Freudian slip later, and we are all rascals now. On another level, it's just rude. We clergy might be limiting factors to growth, but we're the ones who have been plugging our way through the hell of this pandemic, keeping food banks open, hospital chaplaincies staffed, lonely old and young people telephoned. We've had to learn how to put services on YouTube, hold prayer meetings on Zoom and minister to devastated families in desolate funerals of six, while those much maligned old churches became the focus of a fervent public desire to have them open. And thank God for our theological training. Where is God in a pandemic? That's the question so many have asked me since last year, and I could only stumble towards an answer, because long ago I had studied the theology of the cross and the book of Job. This plan isn't just rude, it's dangerous. 10,000 new lay-led churches, open quotes, 20 or 30 people meeting in a home, close quotes, which will bring in 1 million new members. Where to start with this? Perhaps we should start with the sacraments, because 10,000 lay-led churches without all those expensive priests to celebrate communion starts to raise the question of what we mean by church. Let's also ask where we're going to find 10,000 people rich enough to be able, without any pay, to devote the vast amount of time needed to lead a church, with all those pastoral responsibilities, safeguarding duties and person management, which I promise will be necessary with or without the key limiting factor of an actual church building. Then we're going to need to make sure they have a house big enough to host 20 or 30 people for acts of worship, which I suppose takes us back to finding 10,000 people with private means. Then, being entirely reliant upon 10,000 for their time, money and palatial residence, are we quite sure we want to place them in pastoral oversight of 1 million brand new Christians without any of that costly, limiting theological and pastoral education? At the absolute best, this is going to be the biggest exercise in displacement activity in the history of the church. There are currently 12,500 parishes in the C of E, which have taken 1,500 years to develop organically. We are talking about almost doubling that number in 10 years. That's 3 a day. If we take this seriously, every sinew of the organisational structure of the church will be dedicated to nothing else for a decade. That's the best case scenario. The worst takes us back 5 months to the Spectator's rascally cover piece. The trigger for concern then was a leak to the Sunday Times of an internal church document on how to respond to the pandemic. It included this smoking gun. Many diocesan leaders believe that the financial challenges being exposed by the pandemic mean this is the moment to embark on radical changes to reshape existing resource patterns and ministry structures. In the panic following the leak, the archbishops gave a number of assurances, in which a certain sleight of hand could be discerned. The first was a denial of any national strategy, which is either negligent to a terrifying degree or totally disingenuous. The 2016 decision to move from the Darlow formula, which subsidised poorer dioceses, to strategic development funding, which could only be spent on new projects, was a national strategy. The consequences were local. For example, Chelmsford Diocese being forced to cull 60 clergy, one-fifth of their total, but the claim that this was all down to local decision-making is just untrue. The consequence is also that all over the country, dioceses are desperately trying to create exciting projects and sexy management roles to attract SDF grants rather than support their existing parishes. If you've wondered why we are suddenly flooded by associate archdeacons, full-time area deans and directors of justice, peace and integrity of creation, yes, really, it's because these can be funded from the magic pot of money, while boring, snoring parishes with their boring, snoring local ministry cannot. There is a national choice being made every time the terms are set for how funding is disbursed, and the decisions are clear for people who are able to wade through the church's management speak. The latest piece of jargon is that we must become a mixed ecology church, where the traditional parish is to sit alongside these exciting new projects. Who could object to that? It sounds so delightfully middle-of-the-roady Anglican. But it isn't. It's taking the traditional Anglican model and forcing it to share space with a totally new way of being Anglican, one drafted in from nonconformity, without the priesthood, the buildings, or the theological education for which Anglicanism has always been known. And this sharing, far from being a benign borrowing of ideas from sister churches, will inevitably become a battle over resources. This isn't suggesting that all parishes are going to be shut down. Of course they aren't. This isn't suggesting the total number of clergy will be cut. Some are certainly being made redundant right now. But overall, the money will simply be repurposed. What this does suggest is that the entire nature of the Church of England is being refashioned, and it is time this refashioning gets proper debate. This is your church. This is not the Archbishop of Canterbury's, nor the House of Bishops, nor the clergy's, not even the General Synod's. It belongs, in a broad sense, to the people of England, regardless of your faith or lack of it, which is why Parliament is still its ultimate decision-making body. And very specifically, it belongs to the laity of the Church of England. You have a say. There are about to be General Synod elections. So stand. Stand and write in your manifesto that you are standing to save the parish. Stand whether you are an evangelical or an Anglo-Catholic or a high churchman. Stand if you are a female priest or a woman who doesn't think women can be priests. Stand if you want to save the parish because these are your parishes. And this is the only important question for the next 5 years. Stand because this really might be the last chance to save the church we love. And if we're going to promise to save the church, let's use those limiting factors as our banners. A building and a stipend and long, costly college-based training for every leader of the church. That sounds like an ambition worth having, and a more plausible and desirable one than 10,000 mansion churches led by the untrained super-rich. Let us be a key limiting factor, not to the growth of the Church of England, but to the emergence of a church we do not want and we do not need.
That was the Reverend Marcus Walker. Now, Douglas Murray looks at the interesting case of Ollie London, a white British influencer who now identifies as Korean and has had cosmetic surgery to reflect his new self.
Ollie London and the Trickiness of Being Transracial by Douglas Murray. Not everyone will have heard of Ollie London, a British social media influencer who made news for two reasons last week. The first was that London came out as plural, which is to say that he came out as a non-binary person, which is very 2020 and something so unnoteworthy that I'm sure you'll agree it is hardly worth remarking upon. The other thing London did was more unusual, which was that he came out as Korean. You might guess from his name that Ollie London is not Korean, but he has spent some time there, in the south rather than the north apparently, and enjoys the language and culture. So, in his coming out message, London revealed some rather extreme plastic surgery to his face and announced that he wished to be known as Korean. People might not get it, it's a new concept, whatever, he said, demonstrating that whatever his proficiency at Korean, he retains that millennial urge to mutilate the English tongue. On the matter of coming out as Korean, the reception was not universally warm. But you might have sympathy for the crossroads at which this confused young man sits. The current era has arrived at an uncomfortable, indeed contradictory, settlement on such matters. It has decided that a man may become a woman, or a woman may become a man, with great ease. Indeed, saying it makes it so. To such an extent that last month, when a man in LA allegedly identified as trans in order to get into the women's changing room of a spa and wave his penis around at the women in the changing room, the only thing anyone was meant to say to the women who complained was, "What's your problem, transphobe?" This is no exaggeration. Last weekend in California, crowds of Antifa activists assaulted a number of women and a Korean man, as it happens, who were protesting against such activities at the spa. In 2021, fighting fascism means beating up women who do not want penises flashed at them in a spa changing room. One of several reasons why this is a wonderful time to be alive. But while the idea of changing sex has been embedded that deeply, the idea that you can change race is having a trickier time. In recent years, America has seen a small spate of people who have been outed as not being of the race they are pretending to be. Readers may recall the case of Rachel Dolezal, who was not only living as a black woman, but was the head of her local chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People. Her world crashed around her in 2015 when she was outed as not just white, but the child of German-Czech parents. That is, she was outed as exceedingly white. At the time, Dolezal was dismissed as a freak case, but in the years since then, other people have been outed trying honestly or otherwise to be transracial. Last year produced the beautiful case of Jessica Krug, an associate professor at George Washington University, who reluctantly came out as not just white, but Jewish. Miss Krug had hitherto been making ripples in academia as a black woman. Why would a white woman pretend to be a black woman in order to advance in American academia? That is a puzzle we will have to address another day. But the reaction to Krug was essentially the same as to Dolezal. America is even more sensitive about race than it is about sex. So when black people put their foot down and say, "You're not joining our race," it has a firmer impact than it does when women try to put their foot down and say men can't join their sex. And there, the consensus has uncomfortably sat. Only for Ollie London, who uses the pronouns they, them, core, Ian, to come along and baffle everyone. Response to his announcement fell into two broad categories. First was the "how dare you" one, largely voiced by Koreans, and then there were those saying, "Congrats, Ollie, live your best life, chukahay," etc. It's a tricky one. On the side of the Koreans, I can see that having surgery to look like another race is liable to be interpreted as stereotyping, among much else. On the side of the yay people is the fact that it would be rude to tell a young man who's just had elaborate and costly surgery that he is patently nuts. If somebody cuts off his arm and demands to be known as Nelson, it is kindly to refer to him as Nelson. Personally, I would suggest that the Koreans should take it as a compliment. South Korea has in recent years been the country with the highest number of plastic surgery procedures per capita of anywhere in the world. Although people debate the details, the fact is that many of these procedures do appear to be designed to make the patients look more Western, which has always seemed a sad fact to me. It would suggest that a certain Western standard of beauty had got fixed in the country, and it is a rather terrible thing to find neither yourself nor any of your fellow country folk attractive. Perhaps things have changed a little in recent years. The arrival of K-pop may have helped, but whether or not Koreans are now more attracted to themselves, if non-Koreans are becoming so attracted to them that they are having surgery in order to resemble them, as a Korean, I would chalk that up as a win on my side of the ledger. It may take a bit of getting used to, but there have always been people who wished they were of another race. For example, there have been many men in the British Foreign Office who wished that they were Arabs. And if people can buy their way into looking like another sex, we will probably have to get used to the idea that some people will buy their way into looking like another race. You may not agree with this, but I didn't make the rules, and it's not remotely clear which madman did.
That was Douglas Murray. And finally, Petronilla Wyatt gives her two cents on the modern-day Westminster culture, from the hopelessness of Hancock to the Prince Harryfication of Boris Johnson.
The acting one sees upon the stage doesn't show how human beings actually comport themselves in crises, but simply how actors think they ought to. It is the same with politicians, but they are not actors, only a sort of reductio ad absurdum of a thespian. Their profession bears the same relation to proper acting, so-called, as that of a card sharp or a divorce lawyer bears to poetry. Take Michael Gove, who I've known since I was 21, and Matt Hancock, whom I thank God fasting, I don't know at all. Were this a play, Hancock would not have left his wife and three children for a well-known flirt, who I have seen in action on several occasions fluttering her eyelashes at other married men. As for the Goves, I'm sorry they're divorcing, but it is unusual that there is no third party involved. Politicians generally say that to make their divorces appear more palatable. Thus, friends of Boris made the same assertion when he and Marina parted, something that turned out to be untrue. But it is not the case, as Sarah Vine recently wrote, that all political marriages end in failure. There are many happy unions in politics. My parents was one. Although my father was an MP, shadow minister and member of the Lords, I don't recall his character changing for the worse, as Miss Vine claimed was inevitable. My father never neglected his wife or children, or began refusing to wash up. He'd always refused to wash up. Incidentally, I would never let Michael go near my kitchen, as everything about the visible universe fills him with terror. Admittedly, my father had four wives, but not for lack of attention, and indeed perhaps because of a surfeit of it. The first three left him for other men, including a conscientious objector and a male model. The truth is that politicians today possess none of the clean traditions of those of the past. Moreover, they would like us to think that the average powerful, successful man is unable to confine himself to one partner and never has been. Not so. Was Otto von Bismarck not a successful man? If so, he was a strict monogamist and always faithful to his wife Johanna. Again, there is William Gladstone, Ulysses S. Grant, Andrew Jackson, Churchill, Attlee, Harold Wilson, Reagan, George Bush Sr. I could extend the list for pages. But those men, unlike Gove and Hancock, had public spirit, honesty, honour and courage. They stood under no obligation to anything but their principles. This lot today are like bent coppers, and even then they don't always stay bought. I am intrigued by Carrie Johnson's choice of clothes, a mixture of Stepford Wife and Human Sacrifice. She did recently don a blue trouser suit, but she rather resembled one of the victims of Carousel in Logan's Run. I was delighted to be invited on to GB News last week. I was a principal interviewee on Dan Wootton's nightly segment. We had a great deal of fun and engaged in much good-natured ribbing, which these days is as rare as an unoccluded ruby. The most pernicious aspect of woke culture is that it seeks to drain life of all joy. Even clothing has been affected. There is now a woke way to dress. A vintage website that I used to buy from puts a disclaimer under a 1960s gown with a fur trim, saying it is, quote, representative of a time in history that was different than our modern outlook. Strange how woke people struggle with grammar, but perhaps grammar, like dresses with fur trims, has become a symbol of white privilege. There is a debate within the Tory party as to whether it be desirable to attack cancel culture or to ignore it, on the grounds that it is a Westminster bubble matter and of little concern to the average Conservative. This, according to pollster Frank Luntz, would be political suicide. 81% of Tories believe the UK is a nation of, quote, equality and freedom, but half of Labour voters say it is racist and discriminatory. Boris, who tries to be all things to all men, women and transgender folk ever since he met Carrie, has been displaying a kind of moronic ignorance of the wishes of his core base. But to continue with his Prince Harrification under the showgirl red manicured thumbs of the first wife could prove his Götterdämmerung, perilous as the asp at Cleopatra's breast. Wokeism is the new socialism, the battleground over which future elections will be won and lost. Netflix has hired me as a consultant on a documentary about Ghislaine Maxwell. I must be one of the few people who do not regard her as having the vices of Lady Macbeth, Countess Bathory, and Madame Claude combined. She could be curiously tenured, once inviting a happily married friend of mine to meet Bill Clinton in a hotel suite. Needless to say, my friend declined. Back in the 1990s, I used to see teenage girls with eyes the colour of vervain at some of the extravagant parties I was invited to. Looking back, I have a fair idea of why they were there, but it never occurred to me to ask their ages or protest their presence. Was I complicit?
That was Petronella Wyatt. And that's it for Spectator Out Loud this week. If you enjoyed it, please rate and review this podcast on our Best of the Spectator channel, and pick up this week's issue to read more great articles like these three. And if you subscribe now to the magazine at spectator.co.uk/voucher, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon gift voucher. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back with another Spectator Out Loud next week.